From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson is in Washington today trying to convince President Trump to not scrap the Iran nuclear deal. Now, he's not meeting with the president, but he did appear on one of President Trump's favorite shows, Fox and Friends, to make his case.
We think that what you can do is be tougher on Iran, address the concerns of the president, because Plan B does not seem to me to be particularly well developed at this stage.
President Trump has until Saturday to decide whether to stay with the deal or reinstate sanctions that were lifted in 2015 when the deal was struck by the Obama administration. A decision to not waive the sanctions, as has been done periodically since 2015, to reinstate them would basically mean the U.S. is pulling out. Jim Walsh is Here and Now security analyst from the Security Studies Program at MIT. He joins us in the studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
And let's remind people, the president isn't saying Iran is violating the deal, that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. The president is saying he wants to recraft the deal to address other issues.
Yeah, he says he doesn't like the deal. Now, all of the U.S. government, the entire U.S. government, the intelligence agencies, the Department of Defense, the Department of State, everyone says that Iran is complying with its obligations. And so just, I don't think we should put too fine a point on this. I think if we reinstate sanctions on Saturday, the U.S. is cheating. Now, no American wants to use that word with America in the same sentence. But if Iran started to pull back from doing what it was supposed to do on the nuclear piece, what would we call that? We would call that cheating.
Well, but the president and his backers are saying that at a certain point in the deal, the way it's crafted, some of these restrictions on Iran are lifted. He wants to toughen it. He wants to get language in there about Iran's involvement with, you know, terrorism, alleged involvement by the U.S. In terrorism in other countries. Does he have a valid point? Why not use this moment?
Well, if you rip up the agreement, I don't think you're going to get another one. So, I mean, of course, people have complaints about the agreement, and Iranians have complaints about the agreement, too. But we pledge to follow through on our promises. Now, if we don't like certain parts of it, then the way to deal with that is to negotiate a follow-on agreement, one that continues the process and expands the things that Iran has to do, but also expands the benefits that they would receive based on this principle of more for more. But you can't just pick up your toys and walk away to something that you've already agreed to when everyone in the world says it's working.
Well, Iran's President Rouhani said today that his country might not abandon the deal, even if the U.S. does. But you have others saying, and they include Boris Johnson, that only Iran gains if the U.S. pulls out, that they're, you know, even though they say they would stay in a deal, that they, why would they?
Well, sure. I mean, the fact that our closest European ally is here asking us not to pull out suggests that the whole world isn't very happy with this. And we would be self-isolating, right? We pull out. We're the ones who are the cheaters. We pull out. And then that makes us look bad. That gives Iran the freedom of action to do whatever they want. They can stay in the deal. They can get out of the deal. I think they want to stay in the deal, but let's be clear. There are real risks here. Rouhani and Zarif have all these opponents who are chomping at the bit to blame him for this. Mm-hmm. And it may be that because of the domestic politics in Iran, Iran is forced to respond in kind, out of pride, out of domestic unhappiness. And that would mean reintroducing centrifuges. Now, how are we going to react if Iran reintroduces centrifuges? Yeah. I think then you'll hear the talk of war.
Look, North Korea's Kim Jong-un has to be watching this as both countries, the U.S. and North Korea, try to craft the upcoming summit with the president. Now, President Trump says pulling out of the deal with Iran will send Kim a message that the U.S. doesn't back down. Will it do that, or will it send the message to Kim Jong-un, why should I bother crafting a deal with someone?
Well, I can say this, that I've spoken privately with South Korean officials who have been in contact with their North Korean counterparts, and they've told me that North Korea is concerned about this. Can they rely? They're the weakest player in this. Can they really rely on the U.S. to follow through on its promises, given what's happened? But I would say this. If the president, if he breaks this between now and Saturday, it's probably going to be because he's mad or he's emotional or he's unhappy. But if he's strategic about it, he can pull out of the Iran deal anytime he wants, anytime. And so to do it right on the moment where you're trying to negotiate with the North Koreans, you know, why not get a success under your belt and then go after the Iran deal rather than having, you know, the potential for two losses in a row?
Well, and the beginning of talks with North Korea These talks are going to be a lot harder. We understand the North Korean nuclear program. I mean, Iran doesn't have these warheads. North Korea has 40 to 60 nuclear warheads, has a much bigger infrastructure. It's going to be a much harder deal to craft, to monitor.
Yes, this is completely different. And you're right to bring this up, Robin. And people haven't been thinking about it. One is verification, right? One is, are you doing what you're supposed to do? That's going to be tough because this is a country, and I've been there, filled with mountains. And we don't have a baseline. We don't know how much stuff they've already produced. So how do we know what's missing? So yes, that's going to be tough. But there's also a problem of irreversibility. We're just going to have to accept the fact that, like South Africa, once you build a nuclear weapon, even if you give it up, there's some tiny chance that you can go back and do it again. You can't uneducate them. They can't forget what they already learned. So this is going to be a completely different type of challenge.
So your thoughts in the 30 seconds we have, again, as he faces the Iran deadline, what should he be thinking about North Korea?
Well, I think, he can play the Iran card anytime he wants. I think he should focus on the big prize in front of him. If he is able to do something positive with North Korea, and I think that is possible, then that will be a huge victory, more important probably than anything else in his presidency, which is why President Moon mentioned the possibility of a Nobel Prize. So I would urge him to focus on that first.
Jim Walsh here now, security analyst from the Security Studies Program at MIT. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, right now, there are 28 states with comprehensive medical marijuana laws. Ohio will join them in September. The state's program has taken 2 years to get up and running, and a group of educators in Ohio wants to make sure the marijuana workforce is trained and ready to go this fall. Ashton Mara of WCPN IdeaStream reports.
Plants do not exist in isolation, but they interact with other organisms and the environment around them.
Glenn Miller sits in the second row of his Horticulture 101 class, listening as a professor gives a lecture on plant biology. At 61, Miller took a buyout from his former employer, a telecommunications company, and decided instead of retiring, he'd enroll in a training program for a second career, a career in cannabis.
I am interested in the horticultural side of it, so I'll be interested in possibly getting a job at a grow house or a greenhouse, kind of be behind the scenes.
Miller is enrolled at the Cleveland School of Cannabis, located on two floors of a multi-story office building in the Cleveland suburb of Independence. The for-profit school has been open for a little more than a year, and its founder says has one purpose.
We're a career school, and we're in the business of getting people jobs.
Austin Briggs is a Cleveland Heights native who spent several years working in California's marijuana industry. He hopes to help head off in Ohio one of the problems he experienced in the industry on the West Coast, the need for trained workers.
Employers need a place that they can reach out to that's going to be able to certify or co-sign for students to say this person knows what they say they know.
With three certificate programs in horticulture, business, and medical applications, and an executive program that combines all three, Briggs says the Cleveland School of Cannabis is taking the basic plant biology and management techniques taught at institutions across the country and applying them to the marijuana industry, preparing growers, dispensary owners, and everyone in between. The school is not nationally accredited, but it did receive a license from the Ohio Board of Career Colleges and Schools in November. John Ware is its executive director.
We regulate private post-secondary schools and colleges that offer training designed to lead to employment.
Ware says his agency compared the Cleveland School's curriculum to others in California and Colorado. They looked at workforce estimates. Some say 630,000 jobs will be created in the industry nationwide by 2025. Then, Ware says, they discussed the legal implications of licensing a school that prepares workers to grow and sell something the federal government says is illegal. But ultimately, the board signed off.
Because it's been essentially legalized medical marijuana in the state of Ohio, and they are preparing people for what appears to be a legitimate career, we determined that we were going to go ahead and license because the alternative is there would be no oversight.
And no oversight, Ware says, means there's no one to look out for students. A year in, the Cleveland School of Cannabis has about 125 students. They aren't necessarily getting hands-on training because the school can't grow or process marijuana on its current site. But its founder, Austin Briggs, says they partner with growers in other states, giving some students the opportunity to intern in a facility.
We'll also do Skype sessions or FaceTime sessions where we can live stream into grow facilities that are in Oregon or California so that they can still walk through a facility and talk to a grower.
Briggs says they hope to build those same relationships with Ohio growers. Preparing a workforce for the medical marijuana industry hasn't been limited, though, to those wanting a hands-on career in the field. At the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University, Professor Douglas Berman offers a marijuana law, policy, and reform seminar. It's constantly evolving, Berman says, because of the country's changing marijuana laws. So his students are learning the law as it's being created.
It reinforces my sense that there are ways for them to be achieving and successful and impactful in this area of law much quicker than they probably could in any other.
Berman says his seminar offers legal lessons students can put to use right away, much like students at the Cleveland School of Cannabis. Both are preparing a workforce for an industry that's just beginning to bud in Ohio. For Here and Now, I'm Ashton Mara.
Nearly one in three Americans lives with chronic pain. We know opioids can help, but also hurt. We're in a public health crisis of opioid addiction. And now pain experts are looking closer at a low-tech approach focused on lifestyle changes to help patients get off addictive meds. Side Effect Public Media's Christine Herman reports.
Kim Brown has a sideways curve in her spine that has caused pain for years, but it got much worse after an incident in 2010.
It was the simplest thing. I picked up a bag of garbage with my right hand.
And she immediately knew something was wrong.
It blew out a disc, and so that's when the pain really went extreme.
Brown was put on opioids, like so many others who report to the doctor with pain. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in a single year, healthcare providers write enough opioid prescriptions for every adult in the U.S. to have a bottle of pills. Each time Brown came back still in pain, another opioid was added to the list.
Percocet, Vicodin, morphine, Dilaudid. So I was drugged constantly.
And the side effects, primarily constipation, caused such severe abdominal pain she could hardly walk.
It kills your life. It totally robs you of every aspect. I couldn't do anything because of the pain, but I couldn't do anything because of the pain meds.
Brown tried to quit on her own, but after 9 days of nausea and fainting from withdrawal, she was back on the meds.
I finally went to my family doctor and said, I can't live like this anymore. And he referred me to Dr. McManus, and that's when life changed.
Dr. Dennis McManus is the director of the OSF Central Illinois Pain Center in Peoria. He specializes in helping chronic pain sufferers like Brown get off opioids.
From my perspective, if you stabilize the dose and slowly taper off, these patients do remarkably well.
McManus works with a team of providers who help patients make lifestyle changes that reduce pain during everyday activities. He says real change takes commitment from patients.
And most people really just want to have the magic wand that will get them all better. And I'm just trying to say, I don't have a magic wand, but I might have a way out of this jungle that you're in.
The clinic offers physical therapy, massage, nutrition counseling, and psychological therapy. Kim Brown worked with occupational therapist Gabe Stickling, who taught her how to properly lift heavy objects and safely exercise, even when she feels a twinge of pain. On this day, Stickling coached Brown through an elliptical workout.
I can already feel it in my hip.
Okay, we'll go a few more minutes.
He says that people with chronic pain often avoid physical activity.
Because they're afraid they're going to injure themselves or damage their bodies.
But inactivity can make the pain worse. Dr. Erin Krebs is a physician and researcher at the Minneapolis VA healthcare system. She recently authored the first long-term randomized trial of opioids for treating chronic back pain and arthritis. Krebs found they are no better than non-opioid medications.
It's important to remember that the main treatments that are recommended for these pain conditions are not medication treatments.
Krebs says exercise, rehabilitation, and cognitive behavioral therapies are better than opioids for treating chronic pain.
There's general agreement that kind of multidisciplinary or multimodal approach is really the gold standard treatment for chronic pain conditions.
But because non-drug treatments are hands-on and time-intensive, Dr. Dennis McManus says it can be hard to find a clinic that offers them and insurance that will cover them.
A lot cheaper to put someone on a chronic opioid. It's cheaper than having a whole bunch of people work with you.
But Krebs is hopeful that things will change as communities see the hidden costs of opioids.
It's not just the price of the pills. It's also the price of the consequences when you over-rely on something.
Over the course of a 12-week program, Kim Brown tapered off opioids. She says she's thankful this approach helped her get her life back, even though it's a different life than before her injury.
There is no such thing as a pain-free day for me. It never, never fully goes away.
She says she's just learned how to manage life with it. For Here and Now, I'm Christine Herman.
And her story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a health news initiative.
Well, the Oscars of Food are taking place tonight in Chicago. The James Beard Foundation Awards honors excellence in cuisine, culinary writing, and education. One of the nominees is a pastry chef in Birmingham, Alabama, who's been making desserts for more than 30 years. DeLester Miles is the pastry chef at Highlands Bar and Grill, Bottega, and Chez Fonfon, all owned by Chef Frank Stitt. And DeLester Miles joins us now. Welcome and congratulations on your nomination.
Thank you.
And this is not the first time, by the way, that you've been nominated for Outstanding Pastry Chef by the James Beard Foundation. How does it feel to be a finalist this year?
Oh, it's still unbelievable. yes, this is my third year, and it's still hard to believe. It's awesome.
Well, tell us about how you got started in this line of work. When did you first start cooking?
Well, I started, like, when I was younger, being around my mom and her aunt. They used to love to cook, and they used to always get together on holidays and family reunions and different things, and they would get together and cook lemon meringue pies and German chocolate cakes, and I would get in the kitchen with them. I'm like, well, hey, you know, give me the spatula. Let me lick the beaters. So I used to enjoy it, and I wanted to be a part of it. So, you know, as I got older, they used to start letting me cook. So when I got out of college, I decided I wanted to get in the restaurant business, and that's when I got with Frank. And I started off like a grand manger, and then I worked when he opened up Chez Fonfon, I decided I wanted to do the desserts, and I asked him, could I go up and do all of the desserts, and he agreed, so here I am.
What is it that you liked about making desserts in particular?
It's really the first thing you remember, because that was the last thing that you had, and, you know, to see the expression on people's face when they eat them, and, you know, everybody likes something sweet, so... You know, that person is always popular.
Well, and you mentioned Frank. This is Frank Stitt, and Frank and Parta Stitt own Highlands Bar and Grill, Chez Fonfon, Bottega, and Bottega Cafe. You're working for all of them. Do you make different desserts at the different restaurants?
Yes, but we make like a coconut cake. It's such a popular dessert. Basically, we serve it at all the restaurants.
So what makes that cake so special?
I think it's special because it has coconut milk, coconut cream, coconut extract, and then it has the coconut flakes. People just love it.
What's your favorite thing to make?
I like citrus desserts. My favorite is lemon. You know, you give me anything lemon, you got me. Like that sweet and that tangy flavor of the lemons.
And I hear that just today you made a tiramisu as well.
Right. We make ours with a little twist to it. We do, you know, it's traditionally made with ladyfingers. I make it with Polenta pound cake. Mm-hmm. We soak it in espresso and mascarpone, and we top it off with some chocolate shavings.
Now I'm hungry. So one of the interesting things about you as a pastry chef is that you were diagnosed with diabetes. How has that influenced your life and your work?
Oh, well, at first when I found out, it was depressing because you find out that the thing that you love to do, you really can't eat. Mm-hmm. So I had to, like, you know, I try to space myself because, you know, you have to taste. And, you know, it's still hard even today. You know, I was diagnosed with it about 10 years ago. But I'm doing good.
Mm-hmm. And you still taste the desserts sometimes?
Oh, yes. Sometimes I eat them. I can't resist.
Who are your influences?
Well, Frank is one of my influences. You know, I just love what he does. And then, you know, it really started with, like, with my mom and my aunt being in the kitchen with them when I was small. And, you know, I like to watch TV, you know, the Food Networks and stuff like that.
You watch that while you're cooking?
Right, sometime I do, yeah. You know, sometime I'll go watch it and get some pretty good ideas off there.
Yeah. What is the most difficult thing for you to make?
Well, you know, like it was challenging for me when I started making, like, we do like an almond decor. At first, I had never really made one before. So it took me a couple of tries, you know, and doing the meringue and stuff. But now I think I got it down pat. So.
And I've seen you say that you actually, I mean, you've been working there in Birmingham for how long now?
Well, I've been working with Frank for 36 years.
36 years. And I've seen you say that you want to retire there.
Yes.
Why is that?
I'm happy there. I really don't want to go anywhere else. We get along great, so it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. Well, if you win, is anything going to change if you win this James Beard Award?
I don't think so, but I, you know, you never can tell what my opportunities might come up. But right now, I'm happy where I'm at.
And if there's somebody listening to this, a young person who's listening to this, who's thinking maybe they'll get into your line of work to become a pastry chef, what kind of advice would you give them?
I would tell them to follow their dream. You know, I really didn't go to college for it.
You went for computer science, right?
Right. I didn't go for cooking, but I learned by doing and watching, and I think that's the best way. When in my younger days, I used to mess up desserts, throw that in the trash and try it again. Mm-hmm. You know, you just keep doing it until you get it right.
Just keep doing it until you get it right.
Just keep doing it until you get it right.
Well, that's Delester Miles, who is the pastry chef at Highlands Bar and Grill and a number of other restaurants in Birmingham. She's a finalist for a James Beard Foundation Award for Outstanding Pastry Chef. Delester Miles, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
More than 24 homes have been destroyed in Hawaii since Kilauea volcano's latest eruption began last Thursday. The ground has split open, spewing dangerous levels of sulfur dioxide gas, and in some cases releasing molten rock flows in residential neighborhoods. Lava fountains as high as 330 feet and hundreds of earthquakes have been recorded. But it remains unclear how long this will go on. Einat Lev is a volcanologist and assistant research professor at Columbia University. She studies lava flows. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory has compared this to a similar event that happened in 1955. That lasted for 88 days. Do you have any idea how long this eruption is going to continue?
No, we actually have no way of knowing how long this will happen, except for looking at previous similar eruptions. So right now, the estimate is going to say probably a few weeks. But it looks like the seismicity, or that's the earthquakes around the eruption sites, is decreasing. So it could be because there's less magma coming in and maybe it's winding down. It could also be a temporary decrease and then things will wake up again.
We just don't know. Now, we're hearing about these fissures
that
are opening up, at least 10 of them. Lava just seems to appear. Is that unusual?
No, that's very typical of a flank eruption or a rift zone eruption like this one, because the magma is going through an elongated intrusion at the subsurface, and when it reaches the surface, it's going to open up in these linear cracks, and fissures are basically just elongated cracks at the surface.
Now, Kilauea has been disrupting people's lives there for the last several days, but it's actually been erupting since 1983. It makes you wonder if this is a case where maybe people shouldn't have been allowed to build their homes right there in a danger zone.
Right. With any natural hazards, there's always going to be a calculated risk assessment. And admittedly, the last eruption that really disrupted people's lives in that area of the island was decades ago. And if you think about any other hazards like floods or hurricanes or earthquakes, I mean, people live in L.A., people live in San Francisco and Tornado Alley. I don't know. It's really difficult to judge that.
Now, you're joining us from New York. If you were in Hawaii right now, what kind of things would you be looking for? What would you be asking?
I'm particularly interested in how lava lakes convect and circulate, so I would be heading up to the summit and taking a look at how the lake at the summit has basically drained, because all the lava that was filling it up has gone out the side. We haven't been able to see the inside of that lake for a long time. But I would also be very interested in looking at how the flowing lava is interacting with its environment. It's going around forests, around buildings, and this is something that we really need to understand better so that we can have better risk maps for the future and better models.
And why doesn't it just come out of the summit like it does in the movies?
Because there's always going to be a dynamics of balancing the pressure inside the magma system and the topography and the strength of the ground above it. And it's easier sometimes to just go to the side where there's less load and there's maybe a fracture that's more readily opening.
That's Einat Lev, who is a volcanologist at Columbia University. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Earth Day 2018 has come and gone, and now the Earth Day Network is urging people to go forth to take a stand to end plastic pollution, make a commitment to reforestation, pledge to work for environmental education. Great ideas. So how do you start? Well, how about not using glitter? It's made of plastic. Or microbeads, those little plastic beads in beauty products. Or put a ramp in your swimming pool to let drowning frogs out? Wait, what? Michelle Neff is author of Simple Acts to Save Our Planet, a little book with 500 ways to make a difference. She joins us from North Carolina. Michelle, the glitter we understand, glitter and microbeads do what?
So what they do, they're small plastic particles, and they're unable to be filtered through our water treatment system. So what happens is that they go straight into our waterways, straight into our oceans, and unfortunately, marine life ingests them, and that causes problems for marine life. And there's even been some research done that there's microplastics in fish that we consume because it's going straight into our oceans.
Yeah. So we see that, and people can be more mindful about that. But put a ramp in your swimming pool to let the frogs out. It is a horrible thing when there's a frog belly up, you know, in the pool. But you're making the point, what, that, you know, all creatures count?
Absolutely. Like you said, no one wants to come out to their pool and see, you know, a frog belly up. So this simple putting a ramp into your yard, into your pool, it helps save wildlife.
Well, some of us wish we had the pool, but your point is just, you know, help out all creatures. Look, a lot of these simple ideas, we're going to hear more. Some of them sound like, you know, if Martha Stewart were into sustainability, like, for instance, make your own lotion, homemade lotions, personalize your recipe with your favorite essential oils. Can't you just go to a natural store and get lotion?
Sure, absolutely. If you go to a natural store, I would just recommend that you opt for eco-friendly packaging. But if you would like to, of course, you could do it yourself.
Let's go back to some, you know, reminding people of things that they may already have heard of. Swapping reusable items for disposable ones. So napkins, paper towels, you know, replace them with cloth that you might wash. Straws. Talk about straws.
Straws are such a huge problem. You use it for maybe an hour when you're in the restaurant, and then what happens to it? Unfortunately, it goes in the trash, and they're too small to be recycled. They end up in our landfills and then our oceans, and our marine life is unfortunately ingesting them. So by opting for a stainless steel or a glass straw, you can easily prevent that problem and not have to use a plastic straw.
You point out an energy-efficient dishwasher can save 5,000 gallons of water in a year over hand washing dishes. And that's funny because a lot of people think that it's the dishwasher that uses more energy, but the hand washing dishes just lets the water flow. And then empty out the dryer's lint trap every single time. How do you calculate that benefit?
So what happens when you don't empty out your dryer lint, besides it being a fire hazard? But what's happening is when it gets clogged up in the dryer, it's actually making the dryer work harder. So you're using more energy to dry your clothes. So just after every load that you do, just make sure you empty it out.
And some people might, as I did years ago, be thinking, oh, you're supposed to empty that thing out. So, yes, do it every day or every wash. You say sea salt over table salt.
So this is one of the kind of unique tips that is in the book. So sea salt, it's produced through the evaporation of ocean water, and it usually involves very little processing. But on the flip side, table salt, it's mined from underground salt deposits, and it's usually more heavily processed. When you compare the two, sea salt is the more eco-friendly alternative. It's just one of those things to keep in mind in the kitchen.
Because it sounds like every little bit helps. But then let's go back to Martha Stewart territory, because you say make a memory blanket out of your old T-shirts because those T-shirts end up in landfills. So some other suggestions. George W. Bush was right when he said unplug your appliances when they're not in use, even if they're not turned on, because there is some energy drain.
Yep, even if you're not using it, right. It's still sourcing energy.
Right.
So you could lower your electricity bill and help the environment at the same time.
People mocked him, but he was right. Keep your phones on low power mode all the time. Avoid palm oil.
Mm-hmm. Palm oil, it's the world's most popular vegetable oil, and it's commonly found in popular snacks, so ice cream, candy, chips, and other items. But the problem is that even though it is the most popular vegetable oil, it's at a cost to our forest, and the palm oil industry contributes to deforestation. Unfortunately, that's leaving animals without a home. Orangutan populations have decreased by 50% in just the last 10 years due to habitat loss. So when you're out grocery shopping, just opt for palm oil free.
Use e-gift cards instead of the physical gift cards. We've reported on this. How many millions of dollars people lose because they lose the gift card or forget to use it.
Absolutely.
And also they get thrown out and they're plastic. Move earthworms. I do this. If you see after rain, you see earthworms on the sidewalk, gently put them somewhere where they'll be productive.
Yes.
But build a bat house.
Yes, a bat house. So I think that unfortunately bats have a really bad reputation of being these scary little creatures, but they're really fascinating and they're very helpful to our ecosystems. Bats have the ability to pollinate, they control pests, and they spread seeds. So one brown bat, I think this is amazing, they can consume about 600 mosquitoes and other unwanted insects in just an hour. So for me, during the summertime, I do not like mosquitoes, so that's where bats come in handy. So if you want to attract them to your yard, you can easily put up a bat house.
Well, and our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, swears she has bats. She has a little bat nest. She swears by the bat guano, the droppings, for fertilizer. It's got exceptionally high content of nitrogen, phosphate, so there you go. Michelle Neff, author of the newly released Simple Acts to Save Our Planet, Go Build a Bat House. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, to Colorado now, where last week a parent on a campus tour of Colorado State University called 911 to express concern about two Native American brothers on the tour. Thomas Ganawajaran Gray and Lloyd Scanawati Gray borrowed their mother's car and drove 7 hours from New Mexico for the tour when the parents said they stood out. The police came, questioned them, the encounter recorded on a body camera.
Where are you guys from?
New Mexico.
You're coming to school here?
We want to, yeah.
Okay, do you guys have New Mexico IDs?
No, our IDs are in our
bag. I have my ID.
So as you hear, the officer asks for IDs. One of the brothers pulls up an email showing they were meant to be on the tour. Matt Bloom is with KUNC in Greeley, Colorado. Matt, what are people saying about a parent calling police on two kids on a college tour?
You know, CSU is known for being this welcoming place. They have a lot of, you know, cultural diversity offices on campus. And they have a Native American Cultural Center, and everyone is just really shocked and upset that this is happening. You know, whether you talk to people in person or you look at the tweets around the story, it's just complete shock and disbelief that this would happen in a place like CSU. And the people that I've talked to almost don't even want to think about it because they don't think it could happen here.
But it did. Well, the brother's mother is saying that her sons were racially profiled, and the school has apologized and is offering them another tour?
Exactly. They tweeted on Friday that they would pay for the two boys' expenses for the original trip, as well as paying for a VIP all-expenses-paid tour back to campus again. So they're offering to sort of cover this entire thing over with, you know, when they write a check for, you know, making it go away kind of thing.
Well, look, your lieutenant governor there, Donna Lynn, chairs Colorado's Commission of Indian Affairs. She issued a statement about how the young men were treated. We have been having the conversation in the Black Lives Matter movement about racial profiling of African Americans. How common is profiling in your area of Native Americans?
That's a great question. I think that in talking to Lorraine, the mother, and talking to a few other sources for this story, it's something that goes on a lot here. But for some reason, when this incident took place on campus, it sort of was, it kind of became like the tip of the iceberg situation where you see this one glaring example that's captured on body camera footage and a 911 call, and the university is talking about it. It gets sort of blasted out there, and a lot of other, you know, sort of incidences go under the radar, I'm told by people, especially the family. Like, it's a pretty common thing, apparently.
Yeah. Well, the conversation has been elevated. Matt Bloom of KUNC there in Greeley, Colorado, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Tonight in the NBA playoffs, the Philadelphia 76ers take on the Boston Celtics again, and the Toronto Raptors face the Cleveland Cavaliers. So is it okay to root for LeBron James if you're nowhere near Cleveland? Can you cheer on the Golden State Warriors if you're not in the Golden State? Our next guest says absolutely yes. Derek Thompson wants people to support the teams they like and, quote, abandon your sad sack local franchise. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So, of course, you're not talking about the Celtics when you say that, who are doing great right now. But
quite the opposite of a sad sack
franchise,
yes.
Exactly. So, but why should people give up on their hometown team?
Well, first, let me just say that after I published this essay in The Atlantic magazine about a month ago, the blowback has, I would say, been worse than in 1729 when Jonathan Swift published his modest proposal suggesting that people eat the children of the poor. People are not happy about the idea that we abandon the sad sack local franchise. But my take here is pretty simple. Sports is entertainment. Sports is there to make us feel happy. And there's lots of ways to feel happy watching sports. But one way to not feel happy is to root for the Cleveland Browns when they lose 29 games in a row just because your grandfather and his grandfather happened to root for the same team. You should follow what I call a policy of fluid fandom. Allow yourself to fall in love with players and storylines and narratives and teams that you just like. And if that happens to mean abandoning the sad sack local franchise, well, so be it.
Well, you write that America's professional athletic leagues are essentially cartels at this point. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, this is probably the most serious point that I make in the piece, and that is that, you know, in England, there are like more than a dozen local soccer teams, or I should say football teams, in the city of London. But in the U.S., professional sports leagues are essentially cartels. That is, dictate that there can be no more than one team per sport per city, unless the city is really big like New York or Los Angeles. But that essentially means that fans are shackled to one specific team per sport. And if that team is terrible for decades or even generations, well, too bad. The billionaire owner of that franchise is still going to rake in money hand over fist and be able to extort the municipal government by threatening to leave the city because he has all the power. It goes right back to the concept of monopoly. We say that monopolies are bad in every business because it means that consumers are subject to the whims of billionaires. And I think that's exactly what has happened with sports. And one way to break this bind is to allow ourselves to have a more fluid relationship with fandom such that we have the power to determine that we will root for another team without being insulted by all of our friends if we do so.
Well, and to your point, whether the fans in that area like the team or not, the local team, they're probably spending a lot of taxpayer dollars to keep it there.
They absolutely are. Andrew Zimbalist is an economics professor at Smith College who has written prolifically about the financial aspects of sports. And he said that, you know, since 1990, right, so in the last 28 years, local and state governments in the U.S. have spent $24 billion on stadiums for sports, both professional and college. That is far beyond the community value that any particular team can justify. These governments are spending this money because the millionaire and billionaire owners have the monopoly power to demand it. And all I'm suggesting in this piece is that we, the consumers, have the power to break this monopoly power by simply saying, just because my father rooted for this team and just because my uncle rooted for this team does not mean that I am genetically or legally bound to do the same. I have the power to root for the team that makes me happy.
You've got experience with this, Derek. You grew up in Virginia, but you were brainwashed into rooting for the Yankees by your uncle. How did that work out for you?
Yes, let me apologize first of all to all the Boston listeners. I was brainwashed by my uncle in the mid-1990s to be a New York Yankees fan. And this was an auspicious time to become a Yankees fan. They were starting their incredible run of championships. And they also just happened to be led by this guy named Derek Jeter. He shared my first name. It was pretty much written
that was
in
it.
Stone that I was going to be a Yankees fan for life right there. But basically, you know, D.C. sports at the time were terrible. And my dad was like, I don't like any of the hometown teams, so let's just find teams that we like in baseball, in basketball, in football, in hockey. And we did. And so I kind of accidentally adopted this triumphalist attitude towards sports where I fell in love with, you know, Peyton Manning and LeBron James and ended up rooting for, you know, the best quarterback, arguably, and the best basketball player, arguably, in their respective leagues. And I became kind of one of these bandwagoners that constantly had to apologize for my sports allegiances. And this piece is basically my announcement to the world that I'm done apologizing and I would like to present the theory of fluid fandom for popular consumption.
But probably not so easy for you to go to Yankee games when you lived in Virginia.
No, yeah, rather difficult. But easier and easier to watch sports in New York if you live in D.C. or watch sports in, you know, St. Louis if you live in Los Angeles. And easy the reason that fluid fandom, I think, is taking off is A, fantasy sports sort of complicates local allegiance because you're rooting for players who are far flung.
Right.
And then also, you know, cable and internet access allows you to watch all these games across the country. So you really can pick and choose. It is in your power to make that choice.
Well, in the NBA right now, I'm rooting for the Celtics, but I will say, even though I'm not in Cleveland, I still am happy when LeBron does well. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thanks. Go Celts.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.